You're listening to The Purple Mystic, a podcast for the modern witch, with your host, Natalie Sedgwick. Welcome back to The Purple Mystic Podcast. I am your host, Natalie, and today I have the delight of speaking with Dave the Bard. Good morning, Dave.
Hello, Natalie. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Actually, I think it's good afternoon here and good evening there.
Yeah, it's getting that way.
All right. So, Dave, there for people that are not as familiar with you, they may know your music, but they may not know about you personally. I know that you are a member of the Order of Bards, Ovates, and Druids, and a lot of people are going, what in the world is that? So I thought today we'd talk a little bit about that and how the spiritual practice of the order might align with those that are more of a Wiccan or a pagan, just general pagan or a witch nature. I really hate the labels that go flying around, but one of the things that I did want to talk about is the fact that the order is an initiatory group, much like a coven is. So what's the difference there between
Wicca and Druidry? They share a common ancestry, without a doubt. Modern Druidry, anyway. If you go back to the 1950s, there were two gentlemen who were, and I don't necessarily need anyone to do their creative visualization for this, but there were two gentlemen who were at a naturist resort in St. Albans, probably sitting on a bank completely naked, as they were allowed to do, and probably having conversations about spiritual paths and about that. And those two gentlemen were Gerald Gardner and Ross Nichols. Gerald Gardner, if you look at the history of modern craft, is certainly one of the grandfathers of the modern path. He obviously began what became then the Gardnerian tradition of Wicca. And Ross Nichols was a member earlier of the ancient order of Druids, and he, through whatever reason, left to form the Order of Bards, Ovates, and Druids. And these two people were very, very close friends. Ross Nichols also worked at the Atlantis Bookshop where in London, where Gerald Gardner used to hang out quite a lot. And whereas Gardner was looking at the folklore of magic as the root of his tradition, as far as Wicca was concerned and witchcraft, Ross Nichols was looking at the Celtic history, at solar myths, at Celtic mythology and trees. And at the time, the ancient Druid order, they only celebrated the two equinoxes and the summer solstice. And it was the formation of Obod, and those two men having their conversation that formed essentially our modern eightfold wheel of the year. Some people don't like to hear that, but it is a fairly modern creation to have those eightfold wheel of the year cycles to be as one thing. And it took the formation of the Order of Bards, Ovates, and Druids for Druids to then do the celebrate the eightfold wheel of the year. So the bottom line is that modern Druidry, as far as Obod is concerned, and modern Wicca have really strong common roots.
So well, that they're both magical practices too, which I think is what confuses some people, is that there is that underlying belief that in the manipulation of the energies around you. So, you know, whereas some people look at Wicca as, okay, I'm manipulating this energy to meet my needs or suit the needs of myself and those that I serve or my family or whatever. How would the order differ from that, if at all?
So magic, it's a difficult, because there's 20,000 plus members of Obod, and if you ask 50 of those members this question, they probably all answer differently. So right. I can only, with any sense of authority, answer for myself and from my experience of the Druid path. I started my path. I was a, I, back before I found Druidry, I was a member of a ceremonial magic order, and when that did that goes as many ceremonial groups go or magical groups go, it went a bit wrong. I was looking for a path, and of course at the time, this was like the early 90s, very early 90s, the part that, you know, the path of Wicca and Druidry and the Northern tradition were three of the options that you had to explore. And I think the thing that I love, that the thing that made me go down the route of Druidry, is that although magic is everywhere within the Druid tradition, the magic of spellcraft is not the root of the tradition. It's not the most important thing. It's part of it. And I was looking for something that gave me a relationship to the natural world and an equal relationship to the natural world. And when I would go to Wiccan circles, I would hear the words, watchtowers of the East, I do summon and stir and call ye up, which reminded me a great deal of my time in ceremonial magic. It was that, and it felt to me, and please don't ever think this is any kind of criticism, because it's not, it's an observation, and it just didn't feel quite right for my relationship with this thing. It felt more of a power over than a power with.
A partnership with.
Yeah, yes. That's right. And so when you go to a Druid circle, you would hear, with the blessings of the Hawk of Dawn, who soars in the clear, pure air, we call upon the powers of the East. So there's no summon and stirring and calling up of energies. It's an absolute partnership with no idea of summoning. It's, you know, and that, After being in ceremonial magic, which was all about summoning and stirring and conjuring and all that, was a bit of a breath of fresh air for me. And I think if you were to describe Druidry in one sentence, it would be a set of practices that allow a person or encourage a person to have a deeper and more meaningful, close relationship with the spirits of the natural world. That's one, but I would add in both seen and unseen, because I think the natural worlds of spirit are just as much real as the natural worlds of the woodland and the spirits of trees that you can touch and see.
Absolutely.
Now, there is a quick caveat to this, because if you were to say to people, what is a bard? So I belong to the Order of Bards, Ovates and Druids. Yeah. Obod. If you were to say to people, what is a bard? They would say, okay, poetry, storytelling, myth, keeper of law, you know, entertainer around the campfire, kind of thing. If you were to say to them, what's a druid, they would say, okay, I can see a druid. You're talking about Merlin, you're talking about white robes, Stonehenge, all of that sort of stuff.
Cutting the
mistletoe with the golden sickle, all of that. However, even now, after all these years, if you were to ask most people what an ovate was, they wouldn't have any idea.
And those are the seers, the diviners, those that tap into that spiritual energy for guidance. And, you know, I've had to explain that to a few people. In fact, my husband, because he's like, okay, I know what a druid's supposed to be. What the heck's an ovate? He asked that exact question because he he had that image of a bard from all the Renaissance fairy tales and things that he knew. And I have to tell you, for somebody who's adamantly opposed to my spiritual practices, he likes your music.
Oh, right.
I call him humming along. My daughter calls Under a Beltane Sun my witchy kumbaya.
Nice.
So, yeah.
I'll take that.
This is your witchy kumbaya, isn't it? And I was like, yeah, it is. And my husband was humming it the other day. And I said, are you humming Under a Beltane Sun? And he goes, I don't know what you're talking about. He kept going.
Well, I tell you what, there you have answered the question that you asked me, because you described the ovate in those words, the seer, the magician, the shaman, you know, all of those things. Mm-hmm. To me, the ovate is the druid witch. It's all of those things that we recognize with as being part of being a witch or being a Wiccan, are held to me within the ovate work of the druid path. And it's held and bookended by the bard and the druid. And there within the center, you have the ovate. And so, you know, when you say what's the difference, I mean, in my heart, I have the beating heart of a witch, you know, I do. But my witchdom is an ovate. That's how it expresses itself.
Right. And I think that the storytelling of the bard taps into some of that spiritual magic itself, because not everyone is a good storyteller, and not everyone is a good storyteller in the same way. I mean, you have people such as yourself, you write music, I can sing. Okay. But I can't write music. I went through years of band playing by ear because I couldn't read the music. It's still looking at a page. I can tell you what the notes are. But to sit down and just pick up a piece of music and play it on my flute, I have to hear it first.
I can't read a note of music.
Bizarre. Isn't that crazy?
I can't read a note. I don't read music at all. I don't even know what it is.
I'm encouraged by that, because for me, it's always been the writing. I write stories. I have written stories and poetry all my life, short stories. I was making up stories as a child. I remember getting my first library card at 3 and walking out with a fat stack of Dr. Seuss, because I could read it too. So for me, the storytelling is in the story itself, but you have to tap into something that's outside of yourself, you know, changing your pitch and your tone and your body language to involve people in that story. You draw them into you where they're like, I want to hear more. Mm-hmm. And that's a gift of its own. But to me, that taps into something outside of yourself, which is that spirit, which almost puts you at that level.
And that spirit in the Druid tradition, we would call that the Awen.
Exactly.
And that is the flowing spirit that is all around us all the time, but like that elusive mistress. It's not like life force, which is always there. The Awen is elusive. It's like fishing for songs. It's like casting your rod into the flow of Arwen, and every now and again you'll catch something, and that will come back, and it will be a story or a song. And sometimes you've almost got it, and it will then get away, and it will never come back again. You know,
frustrating that is. Yes.
Yeah. And that is the Arwen. That is the Arwen itself. You know, which if you look at the stories that go with it, the Arwen is the brew that was brewed within the cauldron of Ceridwen.
Right. That's
where that story and that thing comes from. So yeah, absolutely. And I think the biggest mistake people make is that they think that Awen can only be expressed through what people see as traditional bardic means, and that's storytelling, poetry, music, those kind of stuff. But you know people are so, these days I find a lot of people are, their creativity is oppressed. It's pushed down. It's the last thing you think about, because you've got no time for that. You've got to look after the kids, you've got to clean the house, you've got to go to work and that kind of thing. And so allowing that creativity to come forward, that Awen can be expressed in how you cook your food. It can be expressed in how you bring up your children in a creative manner. It doesn't, and it isn't limited to those, you know, traditional bardic expressions, you know.
I'll be honest with you, though. I think some of the decline of the traditional bardic tradition is due to technology in a way. It's a double-edged sword, because we have TV, which no longer requires us to sit around a campfire and tell stories to one another. Mm. It used to be a part of the fabric of who we were. Families would get together. I mean, even in the old Christmas songs, you hear them talk about their gathering around the fire and telling tales of old. And we don't do that anymore. Now we gather around the TV set and we're told a story. We don't tell our own stories.
Yeah.
And I think that although technology gives us the ability to do what we're doing today, which is in, you know, podcasting is in a way its own storytelling. Making YouTube videos in a way is its own storytelling, and passing down those traditions in a fantastic new way to reach audiences that might never have been reached. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it takes from us the body language and the passing down, the movements, the eye, you know, the facial gestures and things like that, that you don't get with that traditional storytelling anymore.
Yeah.
We need to bring back the storytelling festivals. They have one in Denton, and they do it at the Scarborough Fair in Waxahachie, Texas every year, which due to coronavirus this year was canceled.
Yeah, like so many things.
Devastated. But I every time I go, I always think, Dave needs to come here. They need to get Dave out here. You need to have Dave come and perform at the Scarborough Fair. It would be perfect.
Yeah, you know, people, I think you see that people come alive, though, when you just, when you drop all of the kind of modern constructs and just build a fire in a garden and just sit there, and then somebody would just say, hey, I've got a story to tell. Come closer, come closer. Listen to this. Long ago and before the time of Arthur, on the banks of Lake Bala in Wales, there was a small hut, and living within that hut was a family. And the moment you open up, I can see it in your face. You, what? You
know, yeah, and what's people, gonna come
yeah,
next?
tell me more, you know, and it's an innate need for within humans, I think, to hear tales told by other people in their present, you know, absolutely.
And I think that's why books will never die, even in the digital age. I'm one of those people that I need the physical. I need to hold the book in my hand. I need to smell the pages. You know, I mean, my husband thinks I'm the weirdest person on the planet, but that's the first thing I do when I get a new book. You know, but it's immersion in the entire book. And my mom used to say, when you read, I worry about you. And I'm like, why is that? She said, because you're in the book. Mm. There could be a tornado going on around us and you wouldn't even know it. You don't even hear me talking to you. What happens if something comes up, or you know, because I would read when I was walking, you know, she's like, you're going to get hit by a car or a train. You don't pay attention. But it's, you know, it was, for me, it's that important. So I love the storytelling, and I think that's part of what draws me to, well, that and my love of trees. To me, trees have always been sacred. I will walk out in the middle of the woods and I don't feel lost. People might think I'm lost, but I feel at home among the trees. I've never met a tree I don't like. And my neighbors think I'm an absolute fruit loop because I talk to my trees. You know, my one neighbor over here, she's just accepted it. She's on my Facebook. She's like, eh, you know, you. These people that just moved in are like, because I'm out there talking to my oak tree that's out here, you know. And but I love that tree. I have a special relationship with that specific tree. And, you know, I love my other trees, but that tree, there's something about it since the day we moved into this house.
Yeah.
That I've watched that tree grow from a sapling, and I love that tree. So I think that part of that need to be in the natural world is part of what draws me to the order over others. Because, you know, I mean, there's so many different traditions you can study out there, and I'm not saying one's better than the other for, you know, everybody. But, you know, I've looked at the Cabot Kent Hermetic Temple in Salem, and I've looked to Christopher Penchik's traditions, and they're interesting. You know, Raven Grimassi and his school, and you know, one of the things that kept me away from that particular one is they don't want you involved in anything else. You know, to me that speaks cultish. You know, I the word slipped from my lips, but that was what it smacked of, is, well, you know, you can't study anything else while you're studying them. Well, what if there's other things to learn? Whereas the order kind of opens itself and says, we invite you, but we know we're not the only.
Yeah.
And I like the idea of being able to be close to the natural world. That really is important, because I think that people, we've shut our mind to what magic is. We have a misconception. We think that magic and science are two different things, and one is imaginary and one is not. But science stems from the imagination. To me, imagination is the key to magic. It's the door that opens to magic. And when you close yourself off from imagination, you close yourself off from so much of what's rich in the world, because that's where art and science come from, in my opinion. My very humble opinion.
Yeah, well, so much of what we call science now to our ancestors would have been deemed magic.
Yes, you know? Exactly. And a light.
Yeah, exactly. So I am absolutely 100% sure that one day a scientist somewhere will create a machine, they'll turn it on, and they'll see waves on the screen or something, and those will be what we call magic. They will pick up what magic waves look like, and it's always been there. It's just, and we all know it's there because we can feel it and we utilize it and we ride it. But one day it will be, they will be seen, and of course they won't be called magic waves, they'll be called something else,
right?
That's basically what they will be, you know. And I think I also like to think of magic as enchantment, because magic is it, to me, magic is more than casting a spell or like we say, manipulating that, those waves, those kind of like that web of weird that we talk about, you know, as well. To me, I think that there is the magic of the bardic tradition for me is re-enchantment, because I think you can give yourself over to science in the same way as people can give themselves over to religion.
Yes.
You can say that unless the people in the white coats in the laboratories have told me it's true, then I don't believe it. And that to me is no different to saying, unless the people in the dog collar tell me it's true, I don't believe it. You know, and I think if you go too far either way, it's fundamentalism, you know, and that can be a fundamental atheist or a fundamental, mm-hmm. you know, religion person. You know, I won't say any particular type of religion because it can be any of them, including paganism. Sometimes some people are fundamentalist pagans,
sure.
You know? But I think the idea that if you go too far to one or the other way, the world gets very, very grey. And if I can't watch a sunrise and see magic, then the world has changed to something that is not, in my opinion, it's a place of beauty and wonder. And I think the stories and the songs and the poetry of our ancestors, the tales of Taliesin, the tales of Awajin in Ireland, or the Three Cauldrons, of all those things that we now have from our ancestors' writings that we've translated, to me, they add colour to the world. They re-enchant the world. They give people
Absolutely.
Back the magic of that relationship to the tree. You know, it wasn't long before, it wasn't that long ago when science told us there is no water on the moon. And everyone went, right, I believe you, because you've got a white coat on. There is no water on the moon. And then they found water on the moon. And they said, oh, there is water on the moon. Okay, I believe you. There is water on the moon. You know, it's
exactly.
like, you know, just, I think part of it is that is part of the relationship with the natural worlds, seen and unseen, is to add that enchantment back into our lives. I think, you know, our modern capitalist world is sadly kicking in a little bit, you know, and denying too much.
And you know, I think that part of the decline of humanity per se itself in that regard, and I'm not saying progress isn't a good thing, and some of the modern conveniences we have are very nice. It's great to be able to turn on a light switch, you know, and not burn your house down with candle, but there's a payoff. There's a price for everything that we gain in terms of progress. And I think that that was driven home to me actually in my PhD studies. We had to read an article, and it was about how modern conveniences have actually doubled and tripled the workload for the typical housewife. You know, there used to be a time when women would gather together and do the laundry together on the banks of the river one time a week, and now we have washing machines. And, you know, laundry to me is magic, because you'll do 20 loads and you'll turn around and there will be 20 more that have suddenly appeared.
where are all the socks?
What is this? You know, I'm like, what? It's multiplied. You know, because it's never done. Now housework is never done. It's not relegated to just one day a week. And then on top of that, you have people such as myself that work outside the home that now also have work in the home. So when I come home from work, my day is not done. Not only do I still have to finish all the documentation for all the notes, but I still have all the vacuuming, cleaning, and thank God my husband does the cooking. He made the mistake of saying I didn't marry you for your cooking. Well, then you can do it. Suits me. If you think I like slaving over a hot stove in the middle of a Texas July, you're stupid. By all means, you do it. You know, so he does the cooking, but you know, I mean, there's still, you know, Yi Yangs, we've got seven dogs. Trust me, there's always dog hair that needs to be vacuumed. So, you know, it as much as the modern conveniences are great, I think that the Industrial Revolution has also robbed us of a lot of our time in ways that they thought it was saving us time. You know, it's caused the separation from people and families because now, in order to have all these wonderful things, multiple people have to work. You know, and it's a double-edged sword. I mean, it's great, you know, we're living in a lot more luxury than we ever have, even our poorest, but at the same time, you're always working.
Yeah, but we don't have Vikings.
No, but you know, is that such a bad thing? I don't know. I have a thing for blue eyes. I don't know. You know, a Viking invading my home might have been a good thing.
I did my ancestry and it came back as Danish and Brit, and I looked in the mirror and I said, well, I could have told you that.
Exactly. You know, I'm Irish. Just look at my eyes. The minute I smile, they're gone. You know, so yeah. That was no surprise there. Yeah. So, you know, I agree. I think that we have separated ourselves so much from our environment to the point of, again, it goes back to that idea of conjuring and control. You know, we seek to control our environment rather than to be a part of our environment. And I think it's that whole general attitude that has human arrogance is what I call it. Just plain old human arrogance. We think we are the best of everything around us rather than striving to be the best with what's around us. And to me, the order seems to answer some of that by returning us to part of what we are, not separate from and better than.
That is basically it. I think the one of the mistakes that is made is when we talk about the natural world as if we are not part of it. So
Thank you.
when I go out into the Sussex countryside and I see a human-made pool, a reservoir, to a lot of people that is not natural. That is unnatural because we made it. But doesn't that reinforce the fact that we're still, even that thought is saying, well, that means that humans aren't part of the natural world. Well, we are. A city, no matter how big it is still part of the natural world because we are just animals.
Right.
We are just a part of the animal kingdom of this world. We just happen to be the dominant species, of the
At
animal
the
kingdom,
moment.
at the moment. And so one of the things I always try to do is to try and see, even the things that we do as human beings, that to say, that's still part of the natural world. If we don't look at all the plastic, I don't want this to come get become a downer, right? Because
Right,
I'm
no,
black.
but
If we
you're on it.
if we don't look at all the plastic in the sea and somehow think that's there because of us and we are part of it, and therefore we've got to sort it out. And if we just separate ourselves from it and say, oh, those damned humans, they're just stupid. Well, that's you. If you say that I am part of this living, breathing, incredibly diverse, wonderful planet, and it's up to me to be a part of it that doesn't, wreck it, that's a really good step forward, I think,
I agree. And
yeah.
I think that's true with our relationships with one another as well. You know, you mentioned the ancestry, you know, everybody wants to know where do I come from? We want our roots, right? But we forget that we have a common root. We all come from that divine which creates everything. And so we are all interconnected. And I think we forget that. And so we separate ourselves by race and creed and color instead of recognizing that we're all marching towards the same end, really, and that we need to be here as one to make this place livable and better. I see everything going on right now, and it blows my mind. partly because, my worldview growing up, in terms of talking about people, just looking at people, I was raised that you treat everyone with the same amount of dignity and respect, regardless of their station in life, that what they look like, where they come from, their educational level. It's everyone is worthy of dignity and respect. And when I look around, so for me, I just take for granted that because I was raised that way, everyone treats everyone that way. And so when I look around and I see how ugly everyone is to one another, it appalls me. I mean, I want to crawl into my home and just stay here and never, ever leave. It's like, I can have my groceries delivered now. Perfect. Click. I don't ever have to step out and experience this, but at the same time, when we do that, I think we're also doing ourselves and the world a disservice, because by exactly what you're saying, having to face it and say, okay, I'm part of this in some capacity, what can we do to move towards a solution? It's vital, because if not, we're going to implode.
Indeed. Indeed. But I think it's a long road, it would appear.
Yeah. It's a long road and it's a hard road, but it's a road that needs to be walked in bare feet, or we're never going to understand what we're doing.
Yeah, I think,
And I think, and here's going back to the barn, I think that the music and the storytelling is part of that healing. I think that that expression, music is an art in whatever form you make it. It's an art. And that art is that expression of our need to express our own divine nature that we share with that which creates us. And so I think that it can be a tool for healing, because it allows us to express to others in a visual way or in an auditory way or in a tactile way the pain and the frustration and the hope that we experience.
Yeah.
And that's what I love about your music, is for me, it does that. I can't even tell you, the very first song I ever heard by you was Cauldron Born. Mm-hmm. And I was just opening my path. I mean, I've always been very drawn to the world of magic, and it started with a love of myth and mythos of various different cultures, Greek, whatever. Eventually, as a child, believe it or not, I was not a popular kid growing up. People thought I was weird. I don't understand that. But I spent a lot of time in the library, because I begged the librarian to let me work in the library after school, helping to restack books and, resetting those cards in the card catalog when some moron pulled the drawer out too much and they went spilling across the floor. And, poor Ms. Wallace, she would be sitting there going, and I was like, I'll help you with that. She was happy to have the help. And nobody else wanted help. So I started getting into other types of mythology, and it led me into the Celtic mythology. And that opened up a whole new world for me too. It spoke to something in me. All of the Scottish folk tales and the Irish folk tales, and there was something about it that spoke to something in me. And it was later on that I realized that the Morrigan had always been there. Mm-hmm. In some capacity, and I didn't realize it, and it's taken her this long to go, I'm talking to you, and my sister even told me, don't you remember when we were sitting in grandmother's backyard and that big black bird came and dropped something on you, at your feet, and my mom asked you, what it was, and you said, oh, it's a gift. It was like a button or something. Just out of the blue, this big black bird just dropped a shiny button at my feet. And I was like, I didn't remember this. My sister did, until she brought it back up. And I was like, oh, yeah. Yeah, I forgot. You got mad because I got a gift from the bird and you didn't. But then there was the book called The Hounds of the Morrigan. And I had devoured this book. It's like this thick. It's by Pat O'Shea. And I had devoured the book in like an hour's worth of time. And I actually was like, I remember that. Somebody else mentioned the book recently. I was like, I remember that book now. And the funny thing is, she's the bad guy in the book, but I liked her. That's what I couldn't understand. But again, there was something speaking to me. And it's that I think it's the warrior spirit, the need to fight for what you believe in. And she calls to that even today. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's funny because, you know, I really got into that mythology and the mythos, and it swirls, but it talks to you. And that's where it began for me. Mm-hmm. And then when I heard Cauldron Born, I was like, wow. You know, and I mean, it's not even about the Morrigan, but it's that, again, it goes into all of that Celtic mythology that spoke to me in the first place, and the rebirth from the cauldron and owning the magic. And I was like, man, I got to find out who this guy is. Because a friend of mine was using it as an intro to one of her videos for YouTube. And I thank her to this day. I'm like, Tequila, I have so much to thank you for. You know, and it was a sign to me, and I knew I was on the right path.
Amazing. Well, you know, to me, music is magic. In ancient Greece, it was part of the four pillars, music of their culture. And I think that when you actually think about music, what is it? It's just a sound. It's just a sound. It's notes, but why is a first, third, and a fifth of this scale pleasing, whereas something else is different and it doesn't work and it sounds off key? Mm-hmm. And why is that? You know, what is it? It's only sound. You know, if I was to grab my guitar right now, okay, I'll grab a guitar, right? If I was playing A chord, A major. Oh yeah, that's nice. Or a D. That's D. Is that D is one of the happiest chords. Yeah, yay! What a lovely, lovely sound. However, I'll drop one finger down one fret. Oh, and that's a minor chord, and that suddenly makes us feel there's a tension there.
Hesitancy. You're like
in the word of Spinal Tap, D minor is the saddest chord in the world. You know. But all I've done is move one finger along a fret, and suddenly our whole emotions are changed by sound. That isn't magic, what is magic?
Well, and I've always said that about musical scores in movies too, because you know something's going to happen just by the music, and you know if it's something to be fearful of or if it's something to be, you know, it speaks to something. And it's the same with smell. Smell is your first sense developed in the womb. Babies smell before they're born. They hear before they're born. And so I think that speaks to that very primal part of who we are. And absolutely, that's magic. Mm. If you can look at a child and not believe in magic, I don't know.
But then you add then you had words to that.
Oh, yeah.
Then you add words. And so not only have you got the magic of this sound, of this minor key or whatever it is, and then you add the words to it. And I think of all the songs ever written, the song that sums up all of that magic to me in sound and words is Comfortably Numb by Pink Floyd. I don't know if you're familiar with Comfortably Numb.
Oh, very. Yeah, it's my favorite Pink Floyd.
So it starts off with a minor chord. Hello, is there anybody in there? And it's minor, and it's reflective, and it's tension. And then it goes to the chorus, and it goes straight to the D minor. There is no pain, you are receding. And it's and instantly there's hope, and you know, that is magic to me. And I have always loved music more than anything else in the world. You know, when I was at school. In fact, I say, picking up on something you said earlier, you know, I was playing a gig once and I looked out and I stopped and I looked out and I said, so this is where all the kids who didn't quite fit into school ended up, isn't it? Mm-hmm. You know, because I think if you like my music, or if you're into the Druid stuff or the pagan stuff, there's something about you. You were probably a weird kid. You know, you weren't necessarily, and this is really tarring the brush of everybody, so I understand it's not the same across the board, but my experience, you know, I was not the kid in the playground swapping football cards with their mates and getting into fights and stuff. I was the quiet kid in the corner listening to T-Rex, The Sweet and Slade and stuff like that. And I was the kid who started to learn play how to play the guitar when I was 8 years old. And just for a little bit of information, we spoke about music and not being able to read. I was taught guitar by an Irish folk musician called Tim O'Leary, his name was, and I was his first student. And Tim was a multi musician, a multi. He could play the harp, the fiddle. He could play any folk instrument you put in his hands, the mandolin, the guitar. Brilliant guitar player, fingerstyle guitar player. But he could not read a note of music. So when I came to him as at 8 years old, he sat down with me, and I had a book. And he says, "I'll do an Irish one. Dave, where's your book? Have you bought your book?" He used to say, "I've got my book." And then he said, I said, "I'm going to play you a triad of notes. And so this is a D chord. Shut your eyes. Listen to it." And he would play it. And he said, "Now I'm going to play a G chord. Listen to it. Is that higher or lower than the D chord?" And I would say, "Oh, that's, you know." And he said, "Okay, now I'm going to play a C chord. Where does that fit in?" And so he trained my ear. He taught me by ear. And if you look at all of the writings, the classical writings of the Druids, it was all about the oral tradition. It was all about hearing and remembering. And my guitar teacher taught me, even though I had no idea of it at the time when I was 8 years old, and I don't know if Tim would have had any idea of it, but he taught me in an incredibly bardic manner. So I cannot read a note of music. I've tried time and time again to look and read, and I just cannot be bothered. I just get a little way in and just go, I just can't be asked with all this notes. All I want to do is play music and enjoy it. So I just give up every time. But I think and people say to me, "Well, how have you written these songs then? That seem to speak to so many people." And I think, well, it's because of Tim. It's because Tim told me and taught me about the emotional connection with the notes and the sound. And so I am absolutely drawn to a song that has a really big chorus hook, so that when it hits that chorus, like Cauldron Bourne, you're there and you want to get up and dance and you want to sing along because it's the key has changed somewhere along the line, or it's just a powerful different type of notes that are put together. And so I think that music is magic. I've seen it with people. I've had letters from people who have said to me, I was at the ends and pits of my life, and then I put on one of your albums, and I suddenly I it gave the world meaning. And I have to, that wasn't me. That's not Dave who's sitting here with my dog underneath my desk. That's the music. That's the creative thing. That's the end result of whatever's come through to create those songs. And sometimes writing a song, it can be the hardest thing in the world. You look at it and it's like, "Oh, I don't ever want to write a song ever again. That was so difficult." And that helped, and that usually happens where I sit down and I say, "Right, I'm going to write a song." And then it's difficult. But then sometimes I will just literally be noodling on the guitar, just playing a few notes on the guitar, and I'll get a little chord change, and I'll go, "Oh, what does that sound like? That sounds like mountains. Okay, well, let's follow it through. Oh, that's like an eagle soaring through the mountain." And then I'll start to sort of sing rubbish. I sing rubbish just to get the melody over these chord changings. And then I'll get a hook that just goes something. Suddenly it'll just go, "Merlin, am I? Merlin, am I?" And suddenly you're off. And those are the moments where you get your fishing rod, you cast it into the stream of Awen, and you just wait patiently and patiently and patiently. And then there's a little tug, and you go, "Oh, I'm not going to pull this one in just yet. I'm just going to wait a little while longer. And I'm going to tease a little bit more out of it until I've got more." And then you pull it, then you've got the song, And sometimes I look at the page after I've written a song, and I can honestly say I don't know how that happened. I didn't plan to do that. I don't know where it came from. I'm not saying it was channeled or anything like that, but there's a
But you gotta
certain.
wonder.
There's just it's like the song and the story want to be told. and that's it.
So
So,
I
yeah.
have to ask you then, do you walk around with a notebook and a pen so that when things strike? Because I do. My husband thinks I'm insane, but not only do I have like a hideous short-term memory, I cannot remember anything that sticks in my head. I'll balance the checkbook, I'll walk to the bedroom to tell him the balance, and I'll mix the numbers up because I have to write it on my palm or I literally don't remember it. So, but it's also because I've had moments where something, an idea has popped in my head and I'm like, oh man, and I'll be like literally driving down the road and I'll be like, oh, that's fantastic. By the time I get home, I won't remember it. So I literally will pull over on the side of the road, and I will write something down in this little notebook with pen that I carry in my bag with me all the time. And then I'll just, pop on the signal, get back on the highway and travel on home because I know I will not remember it by the time I get home. It will be gone.
The answer to that is I have never carried notebooks around with me, and I'll tell you why. Because for me, it's always there's only, out of all of the songs I've ever written, there are only two where I got the words first. If
Really?
all of the other songs that I've written, I have got the melody first. So what I do have, back in the day, I used to have a little
Like voice recorder.
voice recorder. Now I have this beauty, and I have had for
Absolutely.
ages. I have a voice recorder, got the iPhone on me. I have literally got hundreds and hundreds of melodies on that iPhone. And one day each one will become a song. Every now and again, when I'm about to record an album, I will go back and I will go through of some of them, and I'll think about the type of things that I want to sing about, particularly with my Mabinogi albums. I know where those songs are going to fit, and I go, oh, that melody would be perfect for that song. And I haven't got the words yet, but I know that that's the kind of energy that I want to create with that song. So that will become the melody of that song, and then I will create the song from the melody. So thankfully, the iPhone is a gift. And it
Yeah.
has been since the iPhone 3G, which I think was my first one,
Thank
and
you, Steve
X amount of
Jobs.
years ago.
There's an app for that.
There
Thank
is. There
the heavens.
absolutely is. Yeah, want to write a song? There's an app for that.
There's an app for that. Oh, well, that's fantastic. Well, I'm encouraged to know that I'm not the only one that doesn't read music, especially coming from such a gifted musician, because I'll tell you, your music is definitely inspirational. And I know that my friend's going to be listening to this podcast, so I'll take advantage of mentioning Hunter's particular favorite. My friend Nimbus River loves the Green and the Gray.
Green and gray.
And I really like that song because it was actually, I made my mother listen to it because my mother had all the same statements. Oh my God, that's the devil. And I'm like, do you know where the idea, the depiction of the devil comes from? Do you know how much older than your devil that particular image is? And so I had her listen to your song and she was like, well, that's an interesting perspective. And I'm like, well, do a little bit of research, my mom. You might find that what you believe really isn't necessarily the truth or the whole truth. You've been fed bits of truth.
That was an interesting one to write, I have to say. I kind of I, when I found paganism from hermetic magic, I spent a lot of time. Before I'd even written a song, I spent a lot of time around campfires, at Wiccan campfires particularly, and sort of generic pagan campfires, which actually at that time in the early 90s were predominantly Wiccan campfires, without a doubt. And around those campfires, I would hear these chants. We all come from the goddess, Lady, spin your circle bright. Beautiful, beautiful chants. And I was and I when I first heard them, I thought, oh, I found my people. I found my people. I'm sitting around here and I was singing. But then after about like a couple of years, I thought, wow, we need some songs to sing around campfires. We could
Right.
so that's what got me writing songs. But the other thing I noticed, and it is absolutely right after 2,000 years of patriarchy to really give the goddess the love that she deserves. I mean, I absolutely get that. But I think I also felt that the horned god in those chants felt to me a bit shallow. It felt to me like he, in accordance to those myths, he would turn up, he would make love to the goddess, she would have a child, and then he would die. Uh-huh. And I thought, you know, whereas, and I thought, no, there's got to be more to him than that. The horned god, if you look at the stories of Hearn and you know, of Pan and everything, is there's more to it than that. And also I thought, well, for the last 1500 years at least, he has been tarred with this image of being Satan. And nowhere at all in the Bible is Satan described as having cloven hoof and horn.
Nope.
Nowhere. Utterly nowhere. It is not in that book. So this is made up, you know. And I thought, well, how can I address this without being angry about it? How can I address this without having the need to point fingers and stuff like that? Because I don't think that, you know, achieves anything. And so I thought, well, what would happen if one day a fundamental Christian priest would hear the sound of pipes coming from the woods, and he walks and follows the sounds of those pipes, and there within the woods he meets and sees the old horned god of nature. Now to him, that's the devil right there. So what, and to the horned god, he is not the devil, and he doesn't think he's the devil. He's never been the devil.
Right.
Well, what kind of conversation might those two avatars have? What kind of conversation would they have? And Green and Grey was the result, was that conversation.
And I think it's brilliant. It's a brilliant depiction, because I even told my mom, I said, Mom, where do you think the idea of, you know, the devil comes from, the image? Because as you pointed out, it's not in the Bible. And see, when I grew up very strict Church Christ. My mother had us memorizing Bible verses every summer, Old and New Testament. I said, where do you think that comes from? That comes from a bastardization of the gods. Because if you want someone to stop believing in something, what do? You tell them it's bad. It's evil. And that's going to be what changes people's minds and hearts, because I believe people are inherently good. Nobody wants to be bad or evil. Nobody wants to believe in something that's going to bring harm to people. So what do? They turn from it to what you want them to believe. And so it was the artists of the time trying to find some way to get the people, because these gods were important to them. Mm-hmm. He was the one who was the bringer of the spring. He brought the life to the land. And it was a partnership between him and the goddess. So they had a twofold image here. Number one, they're trying to wrest away power from the female side of nature and bring dominance of the male side to the female, rather than a partnership, which was what so many other belief systems were at the time. Women were, in fact, divine in their own right, because they're the bringer forth of life. But it takes two to tango. Mm-hmm. And so he is the inseminator. And I think that they were seeking to not only turn people away from the beliefs that were so very important to them, and they were having trouble with it because they were so very important culturally to those early cultures, but also to turn it from a multi or polytheistic view to a monotheistic, you know. So you have to downplay the importance of the feminine divine while turning the masculine divine from what they see it as, because like it or not, the partnership is inherent there. So it's, you know, and my mom was like, totally. I mean, she stopped talking to me for a while. It took her a while to process.
Well, it's difficult for some people. I think if you know, one of the great things about polytheism is that I can look at Christ and at Yahweh and, you know, and think, gods, okay, that's absolutely, you know, they are real to that path. That's wonderful. The moment you get into monotheism, you know, you lose that ability to talk to people. You know, if monotheism is what you think, then everything else has to be wrong. Whereas whereas polytheism and pantheism and you know, that kind of idea of there are many paths up the mountain kind of idea, but they all reach essentially the same place.
Right.
You know, you can talk to people. You know, I can talk to anybody about anything and not feel the need to tell them they're wrong. And, you know,
exactly. Thank you. That's the key. There is the less judgmental side of things, because you can comprehend that exactly. I love that. There's more paths up the mountain, but they all lead to the top.
Yeah. Yeah.
Some people
prefer the zigzag path, and some people prefer to go up straight up, and some people prefer to climb the Eiger and get up there with rope and tackle. But at the end of the day, you know, we're all searching for something. You know, right. We might, and at the end of the day, a lot of us don't know what it is we're looking for. We just know there is something else, you know, and I think that's the peak, you know, that's what we're.
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. And I think that is the perfect place to just end it. I love that thought. We're all reaching for the summit. So yeah. I appreciate you coming on today. I really do. It's been a delight. I'd love to have you on again to talk a little bit more about your music and other things. So,